Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we welcomed Pedram Razavi, MD, PhD, and Dara S. Ross, MD. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Razavi and Ross discussed the evolution of ESR1 mutation-directed breast cancer management, emphasizing the role of comprehensive genomic testing at metastatic recurrence, including liquid biopsy and tissue sequencing. They highlighted that ESR1 mutations can develop in patients receiving aromatase inhibitors and that the detection of these mutations is crucial for treatment decisions. They also highlighted findings from the Phase 3 SERENA-6 trial, which tested switching to camizestrant upon the emergence of an ESR1 mutation during treatment with an aromatase inhibitor and a CDK4/6 inhibitor ahead of radiographic disease progression in patients with hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. Despite concerns from the FDA's Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee about SERENA-6's design and overall survival outcomes, the experts praised the trial's innovative approach to personalizing breast cancer management based on biomarkers and noted ways that the ODAC decision may affect future clinical research in this field. Thank you so much, Dr. Razavi and Dr. Ross, for taking the time to speak with us on Onc Live On Air today about evolving ESR1 diagnostics in breast cancer. So just to start off, in your practices, how is comprehensive molecular testing typically performed at the time of diagnosis for patients with metastatic breast cancer?
Thanks so much for having us here. Really a pleasure. So I start, and I'm pretty much sure Dr. Ross is going to comment on this as well. Majority of the patients at the time of metastatic recurrence do not have ESR1 mutations, but they have many other alterations that can potentially be actionable, including, you know, PIK3CA mutations that can guide the FDA-approved treatments like the INAVO regimen. So our approach here has been to have comprehensive genomic testing at the time of metastatic recurrence. Part of it is for ESR1 mutations, although we know that the rate of ESR1 mutations at recurrence is relatively low, is around 5% or so in the patients who received aromatase inhibitors in the adjuvant setting, but still has relevance. But all the patients at the time of progression on the first line setting will be also offered comprehensive testing. We prioritize liquid biopsy because many of these mechanisms of resistance are captured by liquid biopsy better. So we know that the rate of ESR1 mutations in liquid biopsy and the ctDNA is far higher than the tissue sequencing, and that's because of a lot of heterogeneity and spatial heterogeneity of the tumor. So we prioritize that, but then we reflect to tissue if ctDNA is not adequate, and our pathologists often advise us, you know, this was not a good sample, you know, this ctDNA sample was not a good one. We may need to, so we have to interpret all of these results with caution and repeat it on tissue when there is indication.
So as you mentioned, comprehensive genomic testing at our institution is so important. It's so valuable for the treatment of our patients here. We analyze several different types of samples for treatment. We generally start with a tissue-based analysis, which can be from the primary tumor or the metastatic tumor. And then obviously there is immense importance in testing circulating tumor DNA. As Dr. Razavi mentioned, ESR1 mutations are a type of acquired resistance that can emerge in up to, you know, almost 50% of patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer after endocrine therapy, particularly aromatase inhibitors, which is why it's so valuable to test either the metastatic tissue or the circulating tumor DNA. And I think that there's great value to have at least one piece of tissue sequenced so that you have good tumor purity in those samples. You know what the varied frequency are in those samples.
We've been sequencing our patients since 2013. Mm-hmm. So at MSK, this has been our standard of care far before we had any indication, approved biomarker-driven, FDA-approved indication for these treatments. And And the idea for us was by sequencing a large number of our patients, and many of that, it was before any insurance approval. So we had philanthropy and institutional funding covering the cost for many of our patients. But that allowed us to have a much better understanding of the genomic profile of metastatic breast cancer, design clinical trials and participate in clinical trials, try to address and identify newer treatments and novel therapies for this type of treatment as well, and also uncover a lot of biology using this approach that we had. But now the field has completely moved on. I think now it is obviously standard of care. Now we have many biomarker-driven therapies. We have to be very proud as a field. In ER-positive metastatic breast cancer, more than two-thirds of the patients have at least one FDA-approved biomarker-driven treatment, meaning that now genomic testing, either with tissue or ctDNA, is a standard of care for patients with breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer.
How has the clinical utility of ctDNA monitoring for resistance and identifying actionable mutations like ESR1 mutations really changed your approach to treating disease progression in particular?
So I can comment on this, and I'm pretty much sure Dr. Ross also has many comments about this as well. But from the clinical standpoint, we have been advocating for precision oncology for a long time. The idea of one size fits all, it was good for the time that we had very limited number of treatments for our patients. I'm old enough to remember the days than when we were rationing our drugs for our patients with ER-positive breast cancer. We had three aromatase inhibitors, then we had one in combination with everolimus, and then we had a few chemotherapy. That was our arsenal of treatment, and fulvestrant, obviously. That was our arsenal of treatment for patients with ER-positive breast cancer in metastatic disease. So we would start with one of them, try to get the maximum amount of benefit from one, and then go to the other one. But things have changed since then. Now, we are on the other end of it. It's a fantastic time to be a breast oncologist, and we have many, many good options for our patients in the approved regimen. And also, many clinical trials are ongoing, so the field is exploding with new treatments. So I think, in my opinion, understanding who would or would not benefit from a treatment in advance is essential and even critical for providing care to a patient. So we are very, very obsessively assess our patients at the time of progression. So if the patient, as just mentioned, at the time of diagnosis, we usually actually do dual analysis with both liquid biopsy and tumor tissue. Dual analysis with liquid biopsy tissue allow us to have a good understanding what are the mutations that are clonal in the tumor. Of those mutations that are in the tumor, which ones are the ones that are represented in the ctDNA, and allow us to interpret the subsequent ctDNA samples much better, and also tell us which ones are acquired in the future, which ones are intrinsic and existed both in the tumor and ctDNA at baseline. So that for that reason, we do both at the beginning. Then at the time of progression, we often start with liquid biopsy. If the patient is undergoing any form of biopsy for clinical reason, they want to see what's the receptor subtype. They want to see if this patient is now HER2 low or ultra low because she was HER2 zero before, and get a biopsy. We often also send that sample for tumor sequencing using our internal assay as well. And this allow us to identify potential mechanisms of response and resistance to therapy, go above and beyond ESR1. ESR1 is extremely important as a predictive biomarker because we know these mutations result in lack of response to estrogen deprivation therapy with aromatase inhibitors. They also result, to some extent, resistant to fulvestrant, some of these alterations, and they predict better outcomes on oral SERDs. And we have multiple of these oral SERDs approved, single agent, and hopefully soon as combination. So for that reason, we do this. But we do not just send for ESR1 testing. We do comprehensive testing because you can identify other alterations. You can identify RB1 loss of function mutation, can identify P10, can identify PIK3CA mutations that can have synergistic effect when they are targeted with the ER pathway, as well as many other alterations. And rarely, but significantly, we often find mutational signatures such as MSI high that are extremely rare in breast cancer, but completely change the trajectory of a patient. So when you find a patient with MMR and MSI high disease with the ER positive disease, those are the patients that prioritizing checkpoint inhibitor for them would be very rational next step. So it is rare, it's very rare to see them in breast cancer, but when we do comprehensive testing for all patients, we started seeing them actually far more than we used to before. And that helps us treat our patients better.
So there are some limitations to testing for ctDNA. One of them is that it requires detection of very low allele frequencies, near almost 0.1%. Some ctDNA-based assays are matched. Some are not matched. It's important to be aware of things like clonal hematopoiesis, which are genetic mutations in hematopoietic stem cells. Those are obviously not mutations that are coming from the tumor, but from patients' stem cells in the blood. And also, if the sample is not matched, you may have germline variants. So when analyzing the reports, it's important for the oncologists and the molecular pathologists to interpret these together as needed to make sure that you understand the mutations that are present, confirm they're coming from the tumor, and the significance of them for the patient's treatment.
I would like to add something here because I think it's important and often it's misunderstood in the field. And that is about interpretation of the ctDNA results. There are many other sources of somatic mutations in ctDNA. So the majority of it, actually, even in a patient with metastatic cancer, a large number of mutations are not coming from cancer, are actually coming from the bone marrow stem cells that throughout the years, they develop mutations that's called clonal hematopoiesis. And because these are very, very active drugs, all of those mutations are also being represented in cell-free DNA. There are also other sources of mutations in the blood as well. At MSK, for example, in the assay that has been developed in our Department of Pathology, and Dr. Ross and colleagues have been very much involved in developing and designing of the assay, it's called MSK Access. We do match the normal sequencing with the white cells. That helps us filter out a lot of these alterations. The assays that are commercially available, many of them remove these alterations in silico or mark them. They report them, but they mark them as possible clonal hematopoiesis. So I really, really encourage our listeners, when they look at the report, go deep into the second, third page. When they talk about, is this mutation real? Is this mutation truly a tumor-derived variant? Or is potentially coming from clonal hematopoiesis? And initially, we thought that many of these alterations are canonical CH alterations. And there is a list of them. These are mutations that often are associated with leukemia, DNMT3A, TET2, ASXL1. But many of the tumor-derived variants also in solid tumors are part of the list as well, TP53, NF1, so on and so forth. So I think SF3B1, so there are a lot of the alterations that we have in breast cancer that can be arising from clonal hematopoiesis. So it's very, very important to interpret these results. Again, go back to my comment, that also helps when you have a tumor tissue. It also helps with the interpretation of cell-free DNA. We know exactly which one of these alterations are potentially coming from the tumor, and also which ones are acquired and are potentially tumor-derived versus coming from CH noise.
So then, are there any ways in which potential declines in quality of life between first and second lines of therapy really affect your treatment decision-making or conversations that you have with patients just about their options as they're moving on to other lines of therapy?
So second and third, as you know, as the patients receive more and more treatment, their functional status goes down, they also can be affected by cancer itself and have start having organ dysfunction. So yes, they have many options for our patients, but at the end of the day, they have to treat our patients. And each patient is unique. They have their own preferences, and they also have their own comorbidities and a genomic profile. The tumor has evolved in a way under the therapeutic pressure of the first line treatment that, you know, many of the other tumors would not. So that when we decide on the choice of treatment for our patient, we try here very hard to practice precision oncology and offer the best treatment for our patient and not just the best treatment or the next line of treatment based on the NCCN guidelines, so on and so forth. Obviously, we follow the guidelines. We follow the FDA approvals for our patients. We also have many clinical trials here that the patients can participate in. But at the end of the day, we have to see if this patient is fit for that treatment and if the patient would benefit from that treatment as well. But overall, this has been the focus here, to personalize the treatment as much as possible to the patient.
But is there anything else that you want to add about any ways that your institution is really optimizing ESR1 testing workflows, or, you know, anything that you really think is important to kind of stay on top of as this becomes more prevalent in practice going forward?
At our institution, we're really optimizing the available assays that we have to detect the various alterations in patients, whether it's at early stages of disease or at later stages of disease, to make sure that they have the best options possible for targeted therapy.
I would say also institutionally, I think having an internal assay, and of course we use external and commercial assays as well, don't take us wrong, but also helps us modify and improve the assay based on the input from the MSK researchers and clinicians. So that MSK impact assay, for example, or tissue assay or MSK access have gone under multiple iterations. And I'm very happy the way that our Department of Molecular Pathology and Innovation Lab do this type of improvements. They have a survey of clinicians. Are there any genes of interest that you think we should add to this assay? Are there any parts of the genome that we have been missing? Are there any clinical questions that have not been addressed in the previous version? So that's a benefit of having an internal assay. But I should add also, many of the commercial assays have now expanded their scope. They include many large part of the genome, exonic. Some of them started to have large intronic regions as well. So, and the workflow for the external assays, they have industry scale capabilities. So the workflow allows them to return the results faster than what we can do in academia. For example, here, our standard is to have the liquid biopsy results within 10 to 14 days. Now outside, you know, many of the commercial assays, we get the results within 7 days. So if that few days make a difference for a patient, we consider that as well when we order the test for the patients.
Yeah, and as Dr. Razavi mentions, you know, another advantage of having the internal assays is that the oncologists and pathologists and various other members of the patient care team can really discuss the details of the results of all the assays. Dr. Razavi and I are both members of our breast molecular tumor board that we have here, where we really go into in-depth discussions of all of the molecular results for the patients on their tissue-based assays, on their ctDNA-based assays. And it's extremely helpful to have all that information in-house.
So then, transitioning a little bit into some specific agents here, we recently heard the ODAC vote regarding the SERENA-6 trial. So can you comment on some of the concerns about the trial that were brought up in the meeting and really just, you know, what you thought about the discussion?
Just a very quick reminder what the trial is before we go to the concerns that the ODAC members brought up. So this is the first ctDNA adaptive clinical trial in breast cancer, trying to, and maybe in solid tumors, trying to address the question, can we proactively go after a mechanism of resistance for which we have a very effective drug before clinical progression happen and improve the outcome of our patients? So that's the premise of the study, and that's the hypothesis here. And the quintessential biomarker that has been discovered in breast oncology with regard to endocrine resistance is ESR1 mutations. You know, as you know, MSK and Dr. Chandrapati was one of the very first who described these ESR1 mutations and the mechanism of actions. And we've been very much involved in development of drugs that go, especially oral SERDs, that go after the ESR1 mutations and also identifying other mechanisms of resistance. But that's the hypothesis. And the hypothesis, in my opinion, has also some biological evolutionary basis. We know breast cancer undergoes extensive amount of evolution, both spatial and temporal. So there is huge amount of heterogeneity in breast cancer. And each time that we impose a bottleneck on breast cancer evolves under the therapeutic pressure that we impose on the tumor. Here, the question is, when a mechanism of resistance, here ESR1 mutation, happens, should we allow that ESR1 clone to expand and become more dominant clone? And at the time that it expands, and that is when the patient has overt clinical progression, change the treatment to a drug that can address this mutation. And we have clinical trials of SERDs, oral SERDs, at the time of progression for patients who have ESR1 mutation. Or at the time of emergence of the ESR1 mutation, when this clone is still a non-dominant clone, small clone, can we go after the ESR1 mutation and try to eradicate? And biologically, this makes sense because the smaller the clone, the less diversity that clone has. So when the clonal diversity is less, we can potentially eradicate or control that clone better than when we have a more dominant clone. That has been the reason why we are so successful in the early stage setting, curing a lot of our patients with therapy, because simply one major factor is that there are not a lot of tumors. So the diversity is less, we have a better chance of eradicating them. And as you expand, as you let the clone expand, there are more driver alterations, more potential resistance alterations that can develop within that ESR1 clone, make them more resistant to the subsequent therapy. So I think that's the biology of it. There is importance for us to understand what's the biology and what is the hypothesis that we try to answer. This is not just simply a sequencing trial. This is a trial that tries, and we have closed after the biology here. And we have been doing this in hematologic malignancies for years. Our colleague on the heme side, they have been monitoring the patients for mutations and identifying mutations that result in certain therapies. Do not wait for the patient to have overt progression before they change the therapy. So these concepts have been proven in oncology. This was the first study in the solid tumor to do it. I think that was something that, in my opinion, has not been discussed enough, both in ODAC and also in the commentaries and the discussions about this trial. This is the importance of this trial. And that's why I think it's a historic trial from that context, because it showed when we go after this particular mechanism of resistance, keep everything the same, but change the backbone of treatment from aromatase inhibitor estrogen deprivation therapy to an oral SERD that is more effective in controlling the ESR1 clone, we can improve the outcome of the patients. And the study was positive. The study with a hazard ratio of 0.46 showed benefit from switch to camizestrin compared to continuing with the aromatase inhibitors. And that was the pre-specified endpoint of the trial. So doesn't matter what happens, this was a positive trial. And I want to emphasize on that. And I also met many of the other endpoints of the trial, showed that the quality of life of the patients can be extended and they can maintain a much better quality of life for longer period of time. So health deterioration significantly improved in the camizestrin group compared to the AI group. And for us who treat the patients with ER-positive breast cancer, that's a huge factor. These are the patients who still have a lot of, relatively less burden of disease or sequela of disease, so they can maintain a very good quality of life. They can go and travel. They can spend quality time with their family. They can work. Many of our patients work full-time despite having metastatic breast cancer. And I think this quality of life and extending the better quality of life for the patients for quite amount of time, actually, this is an important factor for this regimen as well. Also, the PFS2 improved. There was at least a trend towards PFS2 improvement, so on and so forth. The ODAC concerns, I think they brought two concerns, in my opinion, that they're major. There were some other questions. Some of them were answered during the ODAC meeting. But one of them was about OS, that this didn't result in the OS benefit. And I think this is not a fair criticism of the clinical trial. SERENA-6, the OS data for SERENA-6 is not even mature. I think the most updated analysis that they presented, there were only 69 events. So this is not a mature OS event. And I would like to bring some historic context here. None of the clinical trials in the ER-positive metastatic breast cancer that resulted in approval of a drug in the past 10, 15 years had an OS benefit at the time that was resulted in approval. I'm talking about all the CDK4/6 inhibitor trials, all the second-line targeted therapies in that space. They later on showed that there was OS benefit, but at the time that FDA approved the drug, OS benefit was not a factor and seemed like everyone was comfortable at the time. I think there is a different bar for this clinical trial, mainly because it's an innovative design and the field feels uncomfortable with innovation. The other question that was brought up is the question of sequencing. Yeah, if these patients had all, received camizestrant, those with AI, they might have done better. So that was one of the concerns that was brought up. And I think, it would be nice to know that, and that can be done in a potential post-marketing sequencing clinical trial to answer that. But in reality, if you look at these registration global clinical trials, very, very rarely it's feasible to include crossover. The clinical setting changes, the patient's situation changes, the patient develops visceral disease, the patient becomes sick, the patient requires chemotherapy, giving them now camizestrant plus CDK4/6 inhibitor is not even an option on the second line setting, when the patient has overt progression of disease. The patient may develop other genomic alterations, RB1 loss, P10 loss, so on and so forth. Makes me concerned. I do not want to put this patient on CDK4/6 inhibitor anymore because the patient now has a major mechanism of resistance to this combination. I do not want to give this patient this treatment. There are many of these factors that when you put them together, make this crossover design, yes, it's ideal. It would have been nice to have it, but this is not the question that often is answered in any of our clinical trials. And if again, you go back on the CDK4/6 regimen trials, it was not included at the time that approval was done. None of those clinical trials had a crossover design. So they didn't get palbociclib and then they switched to palbociclib in the control arm to see if the patients do better or not, or what is the PFS2 here. So I think it's a different bar. And in my opinion, it is probably not fair because we are holding this clinical trial because it is not a conventional clinical trial to a different standard compared to what we have been very comfortable as a field for many years. We've been advocating precision oncology for years.
Yes.
And what is precision oncology at the end of the day? Precision oncology is giving the right drug to the right patient at the right time. That is precision oncology. That's precision medicine. And it's not a one-size-fits-all type of setting. We have to find a patient who would benefit from this drug. And I would say it is extremely important that now we have the Persevera clinical trial result. If your listeners don't know the trial and they're not in the breast field, that was giredestrant first line, randomized without any biomarker. Patients received SERD plus CDK4/6 versus AI plus CDK4/6. And that trial came back negative. We haven't seen the final results, but the press release says that that study didn't meet its primary endpoint, emphasizing the huge importance of having a biomarker-driven precision oncology in this setting. Not everyone needs to go on an oral SERD. Not everyone needs to receive camizestrin at the time of metastatic diagnosis. There is a subset of patients that at some point in their treatment, they develop a mutation that predicts response to this particular treatment. And what if we change our treatment exactly at that time? And that is the trial design. So in my opinion, this was completely overlooked. Some people, say that, the patients maybe didn't need the camizestrin or oral SERD at all. And that's true. That's very true. And this is the trial that actually avoids 70% of the patients to get the drug, because only around 30% of the patients develop ESR1 mutation during the first-line treatment. The rest of the patients do not have ESR1 mutation. So either have mechanism of resistance that is mutually exclusive with ESR1 mutation. And we have identified many of them. There are many significant mechanism of resistance to endocrine therapy that results in resistance to both SERDs, estrogen deprivation therapy, SERMs, PROTACs, everything. So the patient has a resistance mechanism that is not amenable to this treatment, so those patients don't get it. And there is a group of patients who do amazingly on these drugs. We have outstanding responders on these therapies. They never need to switch. They are doing fantastically on a CDK4/6 inhibitor plus AI. They're tolerated well. They can stay on it for years. Look at the long tail of treatment on every single one of these clinical trials. There is a group of patients who do not need to switch. So I think at the end of the day, this is exactly that value-based oncology. Not everyone should get the drug on day one. And then the way that we have been doing it, because we have not had a lot of good biomarkers, was to identify a fixed period of time, and then they switch the drug. And they have a lot of these type of switch trials. And everyone in the field is comfortable with them. If this trial, for example, was done, patients received 6 months or a year of first-line treatment, and at 1 year without the biomarker, just randomized them to camizestrin versus AI, this would have been a positive trial. This could have been a positive trial, and no one would question the result. You see what I'm trying to say? So I think as a field, this is an unusual design in the solid tumor, but it is the right design. This is exactly what we have set ourselves up for the past decade or more, setting the stage to get to the point that we do a true adaptive ctDNA adaptive clinical trial. And this was done in a phase 3 double-blind placebo-controlled randomized clinical trial, and it delivered on the pre-specified outcome. So I don't know what else we can ask. I hope and I think probably still there is room for FDA to reverse the decision or the recommendation of ODAC and make the right decision, in my opinion, here. But more importantly, it is the message to the field of breast oncology that these type of trials are too risky. So, and this may actually encourage the field not to get involved into this type of adaptive precision oncology clinical trials. That's what worries me. We have done poorly designed adaptive clinical trials in the past, and those clinical trials pushed the big field back by decades. So I really, really hope that in academia, in industry, there is still appetite to do the right thing and design the next studies and the next studies until we show that this is the right way to do this. We have to give the patients the right treatment at the right time. And if we cannot do that on a clinical trial, and if we show that there is benefit, we cannot get it approved for our patients, at the end of the day, our patients are the ones who lose. They are the ones who ask for it. They are the ones who deserve to receive better treatments, not just, a one fit one size fit all, everyone should get this drug. Then the second line, you have these three options. Choose between them. Oh, this doctor prefers this one over the other. And that's it. You know, we do not. This is the way for us to truly personalize our treatments for our patients.
I second that. As Dr. Razavi mentions, you know, we have both worked together for many, many years now, and we have watched the evolution of the field of molecular pathology. We have so many more assays. The quality of the assays has improved so much. The ability to detect such low variant frequency mutations has really improved over the years. So we have the tools, and just the next step is seeing how we can implement those tools into the appropriate assays to provide the patients with the best treatment possible.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.